Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where I hasten to say the intelligence comes from my guest, and in this case, Tosh Berman. And he's written a book about his father, Wallace Berman, who was a very famous artist of the 50s and 60s, and here in Los Angeles, and a part of what we could loosely call the beat movement.
Yes, beat
the
movement.
The beat generation. Uh-huh. And already we're off to an argument, because I personally think the Beats kind of, yeah, they were a little bit in Greenwich Village, but they basically, San Francisco, North Beach, that's the Beats. And there was a hard political edge, not a consistent one, but a hard edge of rebellion, political rebellion, which I don't think we found in La La Land.
La La Land, meaning Los Angeles.
Yeah, okay. Los Angeles. And let's just set the scene. You were raised, you were born in 1954.
Mm-hmm.
This was when L.A. was the magnet for America. You know, people had come out of the military, the economy was booming. I remember it. I was a kid in the Bronx, you know, and people would get a car, pack it up, put everything on the roof, and they'd head out to L.A. I remember somebody, you and I, just talked about before, we called him Peanuts Cone, Herbie Cone, the Cone family, Donald Cone and Muddy Cone. They were legendary in our neighborhood, and they were like the first to put all their stuff in a car, go to L.A. That's, you know, you don't see snow there. You don't get slush in your shoes.
No slush.
Yeah, no slush. And
paradise.
And you pick oranges off the trees.
Yes.
And that, you were born there, and you were born to an early rebel. And in your book, you're a great pains to say your father, Wallace Berman, and the book does very much center on trying to get this man straight, even though you dedicate it to your mother and you love your mother. But clearly you have great admiration for this man who was quite close to you, and you want us to understand them. So why don't we just start there? What was so all-fired important about the art scene, the beat scene in L.A., and that you want to capture in this book, which is called Tosh? And everybody knew you by that name, and, you know, all these incredibly successful, famous people, Dennis Hopper and Allen Ginsberg, Andy Warhol, Lenny Bruce, Robert Duncan, the poet, Michael McClure. You were the kid running around there.
I was a kid running around among these quote-unquote giants of, of culture of that
so,
time.
So what do we need to know about that beat culture of the 50s and 60s?
Well, actually, you know, it's interesting. When you look back, it's a very set thing, the move, like the beat movement or the beat generation. But the fact is, through my eyes, as a child especially, it was really just a collection of misfits of sorts, all artists or poets and writers who somehow did not fit into, at the time, the mainstream of America at the time. They do end up in big cities, which is like New York, of course, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, as well as, you know, as Paris, France. It's a mixture of, like, different, you know, separate individuals. Like, you could think of the beat movement as the big three. You could think of Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, and Waymes Burroughs.
And I put Lawrence Ferlinghetti in there. And in your book, what I found some of the loveliest, most touching points, full confession, I worked at the bookstore after I got thrown out of graduate school in Berkeley for about 3 years. And you really have a wonderful description of City Lights Books, which, by the way, is the publisher.
Yeah, this is my publisher. City Lights was the first bookstore I ever been to in my life as a child. It was like my very first bookstore. So the fact that I'm published by City Lights now is this amazing circle. I mean, it's just incredibly awesome. I can't think of a better word. But when I first went to City Lights, it was my first discovery of a retail store that sold something I was interested in, because we had a lot of books at home. And my father was really good friends with Robert Duncan and Jess, his partner. And Robert's house is full of books, Robert and Jess's house. So this is the first time we went to a public space that's full of books. I'd never really been to a library at that point. But it was my first introduction of a bookstore as a culture, like a sort of a social place for a culture. The only thing I didn't like about City Lights, and it was a really major thing at the time, they didn't have any comic books. But nevertheless, I love the object of books. I love how books feel. I love the physical aspect of books. And City Lights just convey that sort of love of literature and the love of the culture and the love of the object of the book. It's very much of a visual thing with me as well as a textual reading thing as well.
And for the people who haven't been there, it's been a big tourist destination. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now these legendary people that you hung around with, Ginsberg and Kerouac and so forth, they have streets mm-hmm. named after them right around.
I believe the alleyway right between the bar there and
Vesuvio's. What do you mean, yes. The bar? And Vesuvio's, the bar, had on, still to this day, I checked out a few days ago, had this statement, "We are itching to get away from Portland, Oregon."
Oddly enough, I went to Portland the next day.
Yeah, well, you know, Portland is actually a great town now. Uh-huh. But what that conveyed was the rebellion against the stultifying atmosphere of the 50s,
yeah.
The Ozzie and Harriet view of life, you know, uh-huh. Get the Westinghouse refrigerator,
yes.
Get the Nash Oldsmobile, you know, car. Yes. And you'll have happiness.
Yes.
And here was a group of misfits, as you describe them. And I just want to ask you one question mm-hmm. about, for my money, the most important of those misfits, Allen Ginsberg.
Mm.
And in your book, you have pictures of yourself as a kid
yes.
with Allen Ginsberg. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. In Allen Ginsberg's most famous poem, he begins, "America, I'm putting my queer shoulder to the wheel."
Mm-hmm.
And people don't realize, you know, where being gay in California, as in mm-hmm. much of the country, was a crime until quite late. Mm-hmm. So when Allen Ginsberg wrote that in a poem, everybody knows people were arrested at City Lights for selling Howl because
yes.
it had yeah. what was called obscene language. But the use of the word queer then,
mm-hmm.
which now is an accepted movement and human rights movement
yes.
throughout the world, did you know that being gay was an issue?
Not at all. My first gay person I ever met was Robert Duncan and Jess. And I knew as a child they were a couple. But it was before I didn't know anything about sexuality or sexual anything. It was just, you know, I was like 8 years old. But I did know they were a couple. That I did know. I didn't know they were homosexual, gay, queer. Those terms had no meaning to me at that age and time. But I definitely knew they were a couple. I knew they were like a married couple.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because that word, not queer, but fag,
mm-hmm.
had a lot of meaning for you mm-hmm. when you were in high school.
Yes.
And you had three gym teachers.
Three gym teachers.
That's an incredible trajectory. There you are,
yeah.
Topanga Canyon, for people mm-hmm. who don't know it, is kind of the idyllic Wild West of Bohemians
yeah.
in a way.
At the height of the 60s, especially.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and you're with these people who were, some of them, very famous actors,
mm-hmm.
writers, and so forth. Yet when you go to high school, so what year would that be?
Like 1968, 1969.
And 1968, when we've had the 60s, we've had sexual liberation, we've had the women's movement, we've had all of these things.
Except for public schools, that didn't happen.
But we didn't have gay liberation.
Not gay
Stonewall mm-hmm. comes 3 years or two, 3 years later. Mm-hmm. And so what happened to you in junior high school, son of a famous painter?
Well, they didn't care how famous or who he was. They basically saw me as a weirdo from Topanga Canyon. This was in Woodland Hills in the San Fernando Valley. And these three gym teachers, one was old and nice. One was kind of flirtatious to the girl students. And the third one was a total psychotic person, in my opinion. And unfortunately, I landed in the psychotic person's class. And he hated me. Like, he hated me like when you wake up, it's a sunshine. It's that clear that he hated me so much. And he would always make me do extra push-ups or run extra laps because I was never strong or never sports-orientated. I'm definitely not a PE or sports person whatsoever. And he resented me for that. And if I was, like, slow, you know, if I did something wrong, like something physically wrong, he would hold the whole class up till I do it better. Like, he wanted me to climb a rope. I have a severe case of vertigo. There's no way I'm going to climb a rope.
Yeah, you don't like to go up staircases.
I don't like staircases either.
That's in your book. But I want people to understand this moment because it helps explain a lot of what the Beats and then the 60s, hippies and others,
mm-hmm.
were rebelling against, that stifling conformity and stupidity, really.
Well, yes. It's interesting. This is like 68, 69, sort of the, you know, the height of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, sort of even after the hippies. But yet in high schools, in junior high schools, it was still a very conforming culture. And basically, you could not really have really long hair until very, like probably 1970s.
This is not the Deep South. This is
no,
L.A.
This is San Fernando Valley. Yeah. This is Woodland Hills. And I remember one day they called me into their office, the PE office. They shared an office space. Why they have an office, I don't know. I mean, they're always outside. But they had an office space. And I knew it was a bad sign. I knew this was not good. I was there alone with three guys, three men. And basically, they just keep calling me fag this, fag that. And I'm going, at that time, I didn't even know what a fag is, really. I know it's not a good terminology for somebody. But it was very... it was like, I felt like I was in Twilight Zone. I didn't believe I was there hearing this. Because obviously, I was in a closed room with these guys, and I felt this is not really, one, it's not safe, and one, it's just a little weird. It's weird. And then they marched me to the shower, made me take all my clothes off, and as they watched me, I had to wash myself. I had to take a shower. I got out of the shower, and they said, you didn't get your hair wet. You have to wash your hair as well. And my hair was kind of longish. So I said, okay. So I went there, washed my hair. And meanwhile, there's, just verbally abusing me, mostly the word fag I heard over and over again. And they never touched me. I mean, they never physically touched me or hit me of any sort. But the anger of them was something that was really off-putting, of course. But I could not figure out why they were so angry at me and why they were doing this to me. So afterwards, I think I told my parents what happened, but they didn't do anything because, one, they don't want to be involved in the school system or dealing with, this issue really at the time. And also, it's me against them. It was not worth it to them. It was not worth it to me to actually fight this or even... I wasn't angry. I was just totally perturbed. And it didn't emotionally upset me, really. But it was just a really strange incident to go through. It was just really odd.
Well, but Tosh.
Yes, Tosh.
Tosh is the name of this book about the son of Wallace Berman. But think about it, because we think we... when was America great? Donald Trump's bull. Well, America was never great any more than France was ever great or Russia or any other place.
Yes.
They always had oppression and contradictions.
Of course.
And it's really interesting to think you were in a fast-moving circle of successful people. They were rebels, but they knew well-placed, wealthy, powerful people as well.
Well, yes and no. I mean, my father... was a total outsider even in the art world. He's a person who was kicked out of his high school, Fairfax High School, for gambling. He loved to gamble for fun and games. And then he was kicked out of high school.
For people who don't know this, Fairfax is also a big public high school in LA.
Los Angeles, yes. Yeah, and people like Herb Albert and Phil Spector came from Fairfax.
Phil Spector, who's described as kind of a maniac in your book.
Yes, I met him
numerous times. Big record producer.
Yeah, he's, in my opinion, a great artist and a total lunatic. And
Did he really have a bodyguard walk behind him and say that he'll beat you up if I just say the word?
Yeah, after my father died, my father had an exhibit at a gallery, and he was there at the exhibit at the opening. And he was with a bodyguard, this big guy, and he was going up to total strangers and just going up to him while they're talking. And he said, you just go, excuse me, but if I wish, I can have the guy behind me just beat you up.
We're going to run out of time if we don't move this, but let me just, what wisdom did you get from being at the center of an LA art world that has produced very famous people, right?
They were not famous at the time, though, and it's not really a money issue or a power issue at that time. It's more art for art's sake.
Is that true of Andy Warhol also?
Oh, absolutely, in my opinion, yes.
Tell me about Andy Warhol, because he emerges later as a very successful hustler as well as artist.
I think he's a great artist, but he is a hustler as well, and they go hand in hand sometimes. Warhol came to Los Angeles to make a movie, Tarzan and Jane Regained, sort of. It was an early Warhol feature. And my dad was in it. He played the white headhunter. And Taylor Mead played Tarzan. And since I was the only boy there, I played Boy, Tarzan's son, in the movie.
You were in a number of movies, right?
I've been in, underground cinema. And I had a chance to be in Dennis Hopper's Easy Rider, but I turned it down, which I made the movie better for that reason. I think I contribute greatly to Easy Rider and its success by not being in it. But, but this time, everybody was struggling at the time. It wasn't like... nobody actually made it. Everybody was just maybe about to make it, or they're going back and forth about to make it. And my father was very much in the art world, but he was not really part of it as well. You know, he worked differently from other artists.
Describe his achievements, his artwork, for people who might not know his name.
My father is considered the father of California assemblage art, which is using collage sculpture. I don't think that's the right definition, but he's known that. And then he started making collages, photo collages, using a Fairfax copy machine, which is a wet process copy machine that was used in offices during the 60s. And he altered the chemicals. In a way, he made his own dark room. So it became like his canvas, his dark room, and making photos, but doing collages. And the key Singler image of my father that he's famous for is a Singler hand holding a transistor radio, like a Sony radio, and there's images inside the radio. And he has made individual pieces that way, and he also made pieces that are sort of grid-like. And the grid-like pieces, for some, is very similar to Andy Warhol's early work. And it didn't influence each other. Those things are in the air at the time.
But he had his successes. He made record album covers.
Well, he made a drawing that became the cover of an album called Bebop Jazz. And that was the first album, or first 78, that Charlie Parker appeared on. It was a compilation, and Charlie Parker's first appeared on that record. And my dad did the cover for it.
In fact, he flirted with success. He decided at a certain point he'd had a bad experience with a commercial gallery.
Uh-huh.
And he said, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Right, and he didn't.
And so one thing we have to give credit to this group of people is they were battling over not selling out, over integrity.
My father never compromised. He did always what he wanted to do in his art. Never, ever, ever, ever compromised.
And that was in the air, and it was stayed there through the 60s, don't sell out, and so forth. Our students were recording this at the University of Southern California, and if I mention that to my students in class tonight, the general response will be easy for you guys to have said that.
Right.
There was a lot of opportunity then. The economy was booming.
Well, the economy is booming for people who are in the system. If you're outside the system, it's very chancy. I mean, I was not raised as a wealthy.
I know, but I just want, as a little footnote, when I came to Berkeley in 1959, I rented the cottage in the back of a place that Allen Ginsberg had been living in. My rent was $50 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Now, even given the appreciation of the dollar, the fact is you could live a bohemian life. You lived on a boat.
A houseboat.
You lived up in Topanga Canyon. You couldn't live in Topanga Canyon now.
No. There were cabins. There was a cabin at Topanga Canyon.
You know, and there was room for this kind of alternative lifestyle. Now you'd have to be living in a cardboard condominium on Spring Street in the rain, you know, as a homeless person. So I'm not putting down their spirit, but I think there was a strong spirit that you could be independent and still have a good life.
They had no choice. My father had no choice except to be independent. There's no question that he could compromise to the mainstream culture of that time. He just could not do that.
So tell me what you've learned about the art world, and then I have to take a break.
Okay.
Because some of these people went on to be very wealthy and very successful. And they speak admiringly of you. They knew you as a young man.
Wealth, to me, doesn't mean successful. Wealth means they have money, and that's it, and they lose money. So wealth doesn't mean anything to me personally. Basically, the art world at that time was very cottage-like, was very small-town-like. Like Ferris Gallery, which is my dad's first gallery and last gallery, was a very prominent gallery in Los Angeles. It was a gallery that had Andy Warhol's very, very first solo show in Los Angeles, but also he didn't have a solo show in New York till he came to Los Angeles. And it had people like Ed Ruscha, Billy Al Bankston, Larry Bell, and then I think even Rauschenberg from New York had shows, and you know, in the 60s, late 50s and the 60s. So it was very much, everybody knew each other. It was very much a small town community, really. There was art school, but there's no like art school theory. There's no like studying under an artist and follow that artist blueprint of being successful or how to get a gallery. It was more of a Wild West town. It was more like you're on your own, but you had friends who would help you, and you in turn will help them as well.
Yeah, the book is Tosh, City Lights Books, and it's wonderful to read. First of all, you know, I've got three sons. I wish they would write a book about me someday like this. No, it's a love letter.
Yes,
it's a love letter to your family, to your mother and father. Mm-hmm. and to the people around them.
Mm-hmm.
And they deserve it, I think. I mean, as somebody who passed through their world, I think it's an accurate and extremely well-written book, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Well, let me take the break first. And I've been talking to Tosh, the author of Tosh, the son of Wallace Byrne, very famous Los Angeles-based artist, and we'll be right back. We're back with Tosh Berman, the author of Tosh, a terrific book centered around his father, who was a very famous Los Angeles artist, but really about a time that you want to know about because it's when art mattered, when it wasn't done for billionaires, when it wasn't dependent upon kissing the tuchus of people who own big galleries or sit on big art boards. These guys, they were the Wild West as writers, as graphic artists.
Truly were.
And so I want to ask you about one painting in particular that's in your book, Tosh, Fuck Nationalism.
Yes.
The Fuck Nationalism.
That's my dad's politics. And it's basically a drawing done on a negative, like sort of a Fairfax collage, early Fairfax collage, where he handwritten Fuck Nationalism. That was my dad's politics, really. He was not really concerned about, if he was alive now, he'd probably be more likely to be a social libertarian than anything else.
That's your dad's politics, but tell us what that drawing was all about.
I think it's basically about his life in the 50s and the 60s. He did not like institutions. He didn't like cops. He didn't like authority. He didn't like the justice system. He didn't like the government. He didn't like any government. He didn't like the nations. He didn't like borders. He never joined a political party. I don't believe he ever voted, but he did give money. He donated artwork to raise money for people who were resisting the draft during the Vietnam War. So he did participate in actions against the Vietnam War and certain other social causes of that time. But he never actually marched in a demonstration or held a banner or participated in a political process at all.
But the reason that caught my eye in your book, the book is Tosh, A Memory of Wallace Berman and the whole wild crowd of, let's call it Los Angeles Beats.
Mm-hmm.
That was drawn in what year?
I believe like 1959 or 1960.
A couple of years later, not very many years later, Paul Krasner of The Realist magazine came out with a red, white, and blue poster with stars on it, and it said, fuck communism.
Huh.
And the great thing was, people were arrested at City Lights Books for using that word, yet the very people that harassed you and made you take the shower probably thought, hey, that's a good sentiment.
Yes.
I'm not going to throw a kid out of school for that.
No way.
And the money made from that poster, I love telling the story, so let me tell it for the umpteenth time, was money that paid for my ticket to go to Vietnam to write about the war in 64 and 65.
Oh.
Paul Krasner, because he made so much money from selling that poster.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't realize until I picked up your book that the idea might have come from your father.
That's the great thing about the 60s. You know, again, it is a small cottage in the political world, the radicals of the time, and the artists. You know, it's just a small world. So things like that were easily picked up. My father, for instance, read The Village Voice when it was a great paper from first page to the very last, including all the ads, everything. He read all the so-called, quote-unquote, underground political press, as well as like the Los Angeles Free Press and all the alternative papers of that time he read.
So I want to ask you about Ginsberg, Allen Ginsberg. I once wrote an essay, a little magazine called Root and Branch, saying poet is priest, and it was a celebration of Ginsberg as a free spirit, as an anarchist thinker. And it was my criticism was of the left, that leftists will become bureaucrats and strangle thought, but Ginsberg has got hold of a very powerful idea. So tell me, was I wrong to be this high on Ginsberg? You knew him through the eyes of, what, an eight-year-old?
Allen seems to be the one. Well, first of all, even as a child, he was extremely famous. People recognized him on the street. I remember going to London. We were in London in the Summer of Love, June 1967. And I remember, like, we were in an Indian restaurant as a child, like 12 or 13. We were in an Indian restaurant, and there was these two women wearing traditional Indian clothing, and they were speaking their own language, but once in a while you hear the words Allen Ginsberg come out of their mouth. And Allen, to me, was incredible at public relations, as well as being a great poet. He's the one who took the responsibility of trying to convey a political message or a social message, more than, say, like Jack Kerouac, who was not really that political.
And to the degree he was actually would probably be a Trump supporter.
Yeah, I know.
He was the angry white male.
Yeah, and I'm surprised. I see that on the road. See, the thing about the Beat Generation is not everybody's the same. They're all like totally different from William Burroughs. Burroughs is totally different from Ginsberg. You know, these are individual writers that were, they met, they became friends, but even politically, I would not say they agree on, you know, on.
No, and for instance, I have interviewed, I'm very close to Ferlinghetti, and who's now celebrating his 100th birthday, and he was a guy who was politicized as a commander in the Navy of an anti-sub boat, and he saw the horrors of war. He went to Nagasaki and witnessed the effect of the dropping of the bomb, and always was a very committed, after that, pacifist, and took his political views seriously, which I do think Ginsberg did as well.
He did, but somebody like, obviously, William S. Burroughs has a sort of more darker side of the Beat thing, and then Kerouac is sort of like a conservative soul and a very much, that's who he is. You know, that's he's not a radical, he's not a left-wing. He's a classic American author who somehow became part of the Beat movement or the head honcho of the Beat Generation.
Because he had anger that some Trump supporters have.
Yeah.
Let's bring it to the present. Kerouac's sitting there in Long Island, I forget where, West Islip or someplace, and he thinks the country's going to hell in a handbasket for very different reasons than Allen Ginsberg thinks it.
Yeah, didn't like commies.
No, and he probably didn't like most people who lived in New York City for one reason or another.
I don't know about that, but he didn't like commies. He didn't. He was for the war, I believe, in Vietnam.
Yeah,
or at least I think his mind was for the military. He's fighting for the soldiery. No, I don't think he thought that deeply about the war or the issues of the Viet Cong versus the U.S. I think he's just basically like, you got to support our troops, right? You got to support the troops no matter what. And I think he took things on that very surface level because he's a guy who dealt with symbols. You know, get in the car, go cross country. You know, that's such an American thing. You know, get on the highway and just go west or go, gee, I want to have a cup of coffee. Let's just go cross the country for a cup of coffee type of thing.
So finally, because we're going to have to wrap this up, let's talk about the end with the big message of this book. I think it's a very valuable book because it tells you about the possibilities of free thought, creativity, independence of spirit within an otherwise conforming, materialistic, capitalist society. Mm-hmm. These people knew the game was rigged.
Mm-hmm.
They knew there were powerful interests, powerful forces. Mm-hmm. As you say, with Kerouac, he was coming from a more right-wing critique. Ginsberg's coming from a more left-wing progressive. But they all knew that America, as it was constructed, was a place of possibility, yes, and they were going to seize those possibilities, but it was far from, forget about it being a perfect world, it was far from being a very interesting world. It was boring in many ways. It was overrun by advertising, by consumerism.
Yeah.
And they were crafting, in fact, there's one scene, I forget who's buying you a hamburger, doesn't want to buy you a hamburger.
Michael McClure.
Oh, is it Michael?
He wouldn't allow me to have a hamburger.
Yeah.
He was in a French restaurant that's very elegant, but very French, and I just wanted a hamburger.
But the damn thing was, these guys cared about French writers.
Yes,
they
did. And my father idolized and loved French surrealism and the Dadas and 19th century Charles Baudelaire, Rimbaud. My dad, that was like my dad's food.
Right, and then you had Kenneth Rexroth celebrating Chinese culture.
Yeah.
Others celebrating Indian culture like Kerouac. So it wasn't just white Europe that fascinated them.
No.
So here you have this, I dare say, band of merry pranksters. They're in L.A. And you didn't like my using La La Land, but this
was Los Angeles, please.
Yeah, but this was the old, you know, L.A., you know, L.A. Yeah. That in the mind of people outside the country, we know there were a lot of people who living here weren't like that. And it was a center of imagining America as a consumerist, boring, you know, wealthy society. And you had these rebels here.
Yeah.
And that's what Tosh is about. If you want to read about people who gave the finger to that world of Hollywood, and actually did it within Hollywood, knew a lot of the players, influenced mass culture.
There's people who are like bridges, and Dennis Hopper was a good bridge between old studio Hollywood and new Hollywood, of course, but also the art world, the avant-garde art world. Hopper was a really unique person that he was somebody in both worlds comfortably. He was very comfortable in the art world, the avant-garde world, but he's also comfortable in the old Hollywood studio system, which was dying out at the time. So he became one of the inventors of the new Hollywood due to Easy Rider, and then with the same producer did Easy Rider also did 5Z Pieces and so on and so on. You know, Jack Nicholson came out of all that.
Warren Beatty.
But the original money of all that came from the Fab Four, the Monkees. The Monkees made the money that Easy Rider could make the movie. And because Bob Rafelson, who produced the Monkees TV show, when the Monkees became successful, they put the money into their own production company, gave money for Easy Rider, and then 5 Easy Pieces and so forth.
So one last story to wrap this up. Tell us how Bob Dylan met the Beatles.
Well, I wasn't there. I was in a suitcase. But Al Aronowitz is a noted journalist now, or well-known. But at the time, my dad met him in the late 50s. And Al Aronowitz was working for like a mainstream New York publication.
The New York Post.
New York Post. And he was interviewing all the Beat personalities, including Kerouac, Ginsberg, so on. And he did an interview with my father, and which my dad never does an interview, but somehow he just was weak that moment, and he agreed to do the interview. After the interview was over and after he left, my dad decided, I don't want to be interviewed by him. So he located him in his hotel, whatever, barged into his space, took his reel-to-reel tapes and destroyed all of them, including the Jack Kerouac and the Ginsberg interviews of the late 50s. Strangely enough, you think Al Aronowitz would be really pissed off at my dad and they'd be lifetime enemies, but they became very close friends afterwards. So Al Aronowitz is the first guy who introduced Bob Dylan. He brought Bob Dylan to meet the Beatles in the Beatles Hotel and introduced marijuana, pot, from Dylan's and Al Aronowitz's world to the Fab Four. Fab Four were not innocent. They were drinkers and also, I think, amphetamine. You know, they were taking pills to keep active and keep going that time.
So let's leave it at that. The book is Tosh, published by City Lights Books, and it's a terrific read. So pick it up, Tosh. That's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence. Our engineers are KCRW, our Kat Ure, and Mario Diaz. Joshua Shear and Isabel Carrion produced this show, and Sebastian Grubar here at the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.